This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of NPR's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulaby of NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
A reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
we look at how, after the huge success of Avatar, 3D movies are here to stay.
The iconic instant film company Polaroid makes a snappy comeback.
And Governor Deval Patrick rediscovers his connection to his father, jazz saxophonist Pat Patrick. But first,
from Jimi Hendrix's pyrotechnic guitar playing to Johnny Cash's subversive flipping of the bird, the music of the 1960s is the stuff of legend. And thanks to Jim Marshall and his mighty camera, many of the era's great moments were immortalized. Annie Leibovitz called him the rock and roll photographer. Jim Marshall died last week, and NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates had this appreciation.
Jim Marshall fell deeply and irrevocably in love in 1959. The object of his enduring affection, a Leica M2 camera. One snap and there was no looking back. He spent most of his career documenting jazz artists and the blossoming rock scene in San Francisco.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you...
Joel Selvin is a senior rock critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. He and Marshall were close friends and worked together on several photo books.
His photographs of Dylan helped sculpt that guy's public image from the very earliest days. His photographs of Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane are among the most famous photographs of those people that were ever taken.
In an interview on NPR's Day to Day in 2006, Marshall told me he and his subjects' careers were growing up together. They saw him almost as a peer.
It was kind of known that you were taking pictures for publication, and they just let you.
He got those startlingly intimate images by sticking close to his subjects, sometimes for days at a time. It was the only way he'd consent to work.
All access, no doors to be closed, no conditions, that I can go and do what I want and move where I want.
And in that pre-publicist, pre-handler era, he got it. Janis Joplin trusted him enough to take unglamorous photos of her backstage. Marshall said she wasn't afraid to be shown warts and all. He hung with Jimi Hendrix at the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival and came away with indelible photos of a rock genius coming into his own.
Excuse me, why did I kiss this guy?
In 1969, he did Woodstock. All in all, Marshall shot some 500 album covers over the years. The Rolling Stones, Carlos Santana, Jefferson Airplane, Cream, The Who, and The Grateful Dead all showed up in his Leica's lens. Joel Selvin says after enough time has gone by, people will appreciate what he calls the remarkable maelstrom of music Jim Marshall walked through in the 60s and 70s, and
we will see how truly unique and singular those people and those events were, and his viewpoint on it will be the way we see it.
Jim Marshall died in his sleep sometime Tuesday night. He was 74 years old. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
You know, Linda, as someone who does a lot of obits, I was just listening to this enviously, thinking about how lucky Karen Grigsby Bates was to work with all of this incredible music that, in a sense, illustrated the kind of photography she was talking about.
And we'll go over to movies. Fresh off the out-of-this-world success of Avatar, Hollywood studios are clamoring to release more 3D movies. Disney's contribution, Alice in Wonderland, has spent several weeks near the top of the box office, and it's just been joined by DreamWorks' How to Train Your Dragon, and it's about to be joined by Warner Brothers' Clash of the Titans. Frankly, there aren't enough theaters to support this many 3D movies, as the scramble is on to convert screens and equipment to 3D. NPR's Renee Montaigne caught up with reporter Kim Masters to find out about the 3D traffic jam.
there is a glut of 3D product, as they call it, coming into the market. There are now about maybe 4,000 3D screens. And, you know, for a long time, Hollywood was kind of hanging back and thinking, is this really going to catch on? And what happened is Avatar, and they all realized, okay, now we're going to scramble and we want everything in 3D if it's a big popcorn type of movie, you know, what they call a tentpole type of movie. So along comes How to Train Your Dragon this Friday, Warner Brothers coming in with Clash of the Titans, and they're still Alice in Wonderland, and even Avatar is still playing on some 3D screens, so there is a traffic jam.
Does the audience really, though, care if these movies are in 3D? Would they be going to Alice in Wonderland anyway?
Well, Avatar made more than 70% of its money from 3D. So that was a pretty convincing argument that Hollywood heard. And, you know, it's an ironic situation because Jeffrey Katzenberg is the head of DreamWorks Animation. That's the studio that has How to Train Your Dragon. He has been the great leader saying, please convert your screens to 3D. This is the future, a huge revolution. It's like going from silent movies to talkies. It's going to become the standard. Nobody believed him until Avatar came along. And now here he is with How to Train Your Dragon. And Warner Brothers tricked up Clash of the Titans in 3D. It was originally in 2D. But they sort of hastily, seeing the success of Avatar, transformed it into 3D and jammed it 1 week after Jeffrey Katzenberg's movie. So he is now being victimized as there's a war going on over who is going to get which screens. Is it going to be How to Train Your Dragon if you're a theater owner, or are you going to hold out for Clash of the Titans?
Well, you know, you mentioned that it changed it after the fact. It converted it to 3D. It wasn't shot in that.
Right.
Do viewers know the difference?
Well, that is a question that's being hotly debated. There are people who feel that transforming something that's shot into 2D into 3D is kind of a cheap trick. And one of them, perhaps unsurprisingly, is James Cameron, who made Avatar. And here he is telling us why he thinks this is a typical Hollywood move.
It's typical of Hollywood getting it wrong. You know, we do a film that's natively authored in 3D, shot in 3D. So they assume from the success of that that they can then just turn movies into 3D in 8 weeks.
And
throw a switch on 3D, and that's going to work somehow.
And that's James Cameron talking to MTV. So obviously he doesn't think much of this, although I will point out that he is doing a version of Titanic in 3D, but I assume he'll do it to his own very high standards.
Linda, you've posted about 3D movies this past week on Monkey See, and you posed a question that I thought was a really good one, which is the appetite for 3D limitless?
When you look at Avatar as an example, not all of these movies are Avatar. Not all of these movies prioritize the use of 3D the way that Avatar did. Not all of them are designed to show off the 3D the way that Avatar was. And so as it moves into becoming, as they say, the standard, you know, we talked about the fact that Martin Scorsese recently was talking about how everything should be in 3D and said Precious should be in 3D. The other thing that tied into this is that there was a theater price increase this week. And they really bumped up the prices of tickets. They bumped up the prices of regular 2D tickets at several of the big chains at the same time, but also even more bumped up the prices of 3D tickets. And the question is, if you've got a choice between a 2D movie that, you know, and a 3D movie that costs, you know, $5 more per ticket, especially if you're talking about several people, how many movies are people going to want to make that choice for? And can you really convince people to continue to pay that premium when the movie isn't Avatar, when the movie is Hot Tub Time Machine? Are people going to want to pay to watch Hot Tub Time Machine in 3D? I think that's kind of what my question is. I just don't know if Avatar is a good example or an incredibly bad example just because it's so unusual.
Well, we're going to roll the reel of time back to an era where the fancy film technology was actually Polaroid. The company popularized instant photography in the 1960s, but recently it struggled, even to the point of announcing 2 years ago it would stop making instant film. But things change, and an upstart company is now selling Polaroid-compatible film, and Polaroid itself is selling a new image. NPR's Barry Gordimer reports.
That's Lady Gaga, singer, fashion maven, and marketing dynamo. Her new music video for the song Telephone is chock full of strategically placed products, and Polaroid is among the most visible. Lady Gaga isn't just a Polaroid fan. This year, she signed a deal to become a creative director. Reportedly, she also has an equity share in the company. It's a good deal for both sides. Gaga might get some money, and Polaroid gets a big boost in its effort to be cool again.
Meet the swinger, Polaroid swinger. Meet the swinger, Polaroid swinger.
In the 1960s and 70s, Polaroid was the height of cool. It was the Apple of its day. A creative innovator whose founder, Edwin Land, is often compared to Apple's CEO, Steve Jobs.
When people talk about him, they use words like dazzling or fascinating, not so much his personality as his knowledge and his genius that kind of overwhelmed you.
That's David Bushman of the Paley Center for Media in New York. He says when Land debuted his first instant camera in 1948, people thought it was a miracle.
It completely changed the relationship between people and photography and cameras. And the impact of something like that, I think it's difficult to understand today.
Polaroid was a household name, but then digital cameras got big, and who needed instant film when you had digital? Polaroid's reputation shriveled. In 2001, the company went bankrupt. Then it was bought by a man who later would be convicted of running a multi-billion-dollar Ponzi scheme. The biggest blow came in 2008, when Polaroid announced it would stop making its iconic instant film. The company went bankrupt again. But instant film was not dead yet. A group of Polaroid fans and ex-employees formed a company called The Impossible Project. They took over an old Polaroid factory in the Netherlands and started making instant film again, using a different process, though, because the original Polaroid chemicals were no longer available. Andre Boseman headed up the project.
I'm sure if you would make a phone call with some of the old research people from Polaroid, they would assure you that we were mad.
It was an incredible risk, but late last year, the Impossible Project struck a licensing deal with PLRIP. New black and white film goes on sale today. Color is coming soon. Boseman says it's clearer and crisper than the original film, but that may not be what Polaroid enthusiasts want. Photo historian Claude Cookman describes the appeal of the original film.
The colors feel quite different. They are not crisp and clear and has a certain retro feel to it in terms of its color and its size. And I think this is a really important dimension of it.
And here again is David Bushman of the Paley Center.
Today, when we're used to looking at, you know, HDTV and digital photography and so on, there's something very quaint and very sort of, I don't know what the comparable word to otherworldly is, but it has a very nostalgic value to it for that reason.
Polaroid Scott Hardy says there is a market for instant film, even if it's a small one. And the company's not banking on film alone. It also sells other products, including digital cameras, one with a built-in instant printer. But technology journalist Mark McCluskey is skeptical that Polaroid will become a household name again.
It seems unlikely to me that Polaroid's going to regain that status in the marketplace. You know, stranger things have certainly happened in this world, but they have a long road ahead of them.
Whatever happens with Polaroid, at least it's got Lady Gaga along for the ride. Barry Gordimer, NPR News, Washington.
Mose Allison may not have videos quite as prominent as those of Lady Gaga, but at age 82, he's lost none of his edge. He started on piano at age 5 on his parents' farm in the Mississippi Delta. He absorbed the blues and jazz, boogie-woogie, and bebop. He played in bands throughout the South and in the 50s joined the jazz scene in New York. His songs have been covered by everyone from Bonnie Raitt to The Who to The Clash. Mose Allison has some 50 albums to his name, but his new recording, titled The Way of the World, is his first in 12 years, and it was producer Joe Henry who coaxed him back into the studio. Melissa Block recently spoke to the musician and the producer and asked Mose Allison what took him so long.
I figured, you know, I had a lot of albums out there, and none of them were selling, so I didn't see any need to make a new one, you know. But Joe Henry talked me into it. I finally decided, well, why not, you know, let him see what he can do.
And Joe, this was a real campaign for you. How did you do it?
Well, I had brought Mose with me to a festival in Germany that I was curating, and I thought that was my excuse to work with him. And I left there determined to make a full record with him, and he told me he would have none of it. And I badgered him for about 10 months, and then he finally, I guess, just decided that the only way to get rid of me was to show up for 4 days. And then we were in.
Mose, you've been known over the years for your sharp tongue, and I love that you sort of turn that on yourself a little bit in the song My Brain, which starts out really positive. It's this song of praise.
My brain is always ticking, my brain. My brain is always ticking, my brain.
And then by the end, there's this fatalism that creeps in about your brain and the mind and what happens as we age.
Yeah, well, that's the way it works.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've noticed it myself.
Yeah.
My brain, it's losing power, my brain. My brain, it's losing power, my brain. My brain, it's losing power. 1,200 neurons every hour, my brain. Cool little cluster, that's my brain.
I want to ask about something that you're doing on this song and a bunch of the songs on the CD during the piano breaks, where you're vocalizing. It's not quite scat singing. It's not quite humming. Not quite moaning. Let's take a listen. Well, tell me about what you're doing there. Is it a conscious thing at all, or is it spontaneous?
Well, you know, a lot of piano players do that. You know, they all make a noise with their mouth when they're playing. Glenn Gould does it.
Yeah.
And Errol Garner did it. I had to tell Columbia when I was recording for them years ago to dampen it, you know, because they had it almost as loud as the piano, you know.
I was aware going into the sessions that it was something that he wanted de-emphasized. At the same time, as someone who's listened to Mose for a long time and registers that vocalizing as part of his thing, if we got rid of it completely, there was something for me that was diminished. It's a certain kind of glue in the track. I think it's always good when you're reminded that a human being is sitting there doing something, and I'm a sucker for it.
Joe Henry, you, in your liner notes for the CD, you have this great description of Mose Allison being a link from Mark Twain straight through to Willie Dixon, with Chico Marx barking directions from the back seat, James Stewart at the wheel. Pretty good company, Mose.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
I think the first sustained conversation that Mose and I had was not about music. It was about Kurt Vonnegut. For some reason, I had been inclined to be rereading Slaughterhouse Five, and somehow it came up in conversation. I think I had read recently that Kurt Vonnegut had been a big fan of Mose, and Mose was a big fan of Kurt's, and they unfortunately had never had an opportunity to meet.
Mm. You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Over the course of his career, the late jazz saxophonist Pat Patrick shared the stage with a couple of musicians you may have heard of: John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Duke Ellington, and Sun Ra. Patrick died in 1991, unfortunately too early to see his son, Duval, elected governor of Massachusetts 4 years ago. Governor Patrick has donated a vast archive of his father's work, photos, recordings, scores, to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. The school recently celebrated the new Pat Patrick collection with a concert. NPR's Guy Raz asked Governor Patrick if people are ever surprised to discover his connection to such a significant player in jazz history.
They are blown away, I think, because particularly if you know Sun Ra's music, and folks look at me and say, well, that guy's pretty straight by comparison. My relationship with my father was really through his music and really as adults. I didn't know him so well when I was growing up. Mm. And I'm grateful for that music as a pathway to have that relationship with him.
And as you mentioned, you didn't really know your dad well growing up. You sort of got to know him in the last decade of his life. Did you have a sense as a kid of who your dad was in the jazz world?
My parents split when I was about four. And my father lived in New York for most of the time that I was growing up on the south side of Chicago. And we would see him intermittently, you know, when he came through town on a concert tour. But I didn't appreciate his artistry until I was a late teenager, early 20s. After he died in 1991, we had a memorial service early the following year out in East Moline, Illinois, which is where he grew up. He had left to my sisters and me. I have a half-sister, LaShawn, and my sister, Rhonda. All these papers. He was a total pack rat. He kept everything, notes and playbills and recordings of his own record albums that he had acquired over time. And we were so overwhelmed by all this material that we just took a few things, a few instruments, each of us, a few boxes of pictures, and we left the rest of it in my grandmother's care. She passed away, and then we didn't know what came of all the rest of this stuff. And Guy, it was shortly after I was elected governor of the Commonwealth, I got a call from a fellow who described himself as the owner of a storage facility in Moline, Illinois. And he said that there was an abandoned storage facility that had a few boxes left of papers that he had thrown out and then taken out of the dumpster over and over again over a course of a couple of years. And finally, he said he'd read in the paper that I was elected, and he wondered if I was related to Pat Patrick and would I like this stuff. And I said, well, in fact, he was my father, and sure.
Governor Patrick, I know you saw your father play.
Yes.
What was he like on stage?
Completely involved. He made a point of listening very, very closely to what was going on around him and feeding off of what the other musicians were doing and building on it. He would talk about how this or that musician was saying something and not saying something, and he was trying to say something back in what he was playing. The only time I ever saw him focus on something or someone who was not in the ensemble he was with was at my 25th birthday when I was working in Washington. I was in law school and working in Washington in the summer, and he came through on a concert tour and called and said, would you like to get together for your birthday? And I can't remember when before then we had last had a birthday together. And he was performing at a jazz club in Northeast Washington called Pigfoot. I'll never forget it. Small club. And he asked me to come by, and I did for the late set. And I sat at a little table by myself, and he saw me come in, and he said, I want to dedicate this next number to my son, whose birthday is today. And mind you, you know, we had been groping toward having a relationship for years at that point, not always smoothly. And he played this wonderful old standard called I Can't Get Started, which has these incredibly, for us, meaningful lyrics. I don't know if you know the tune, but it's, I think it goes something like, I've been around the world in a plane. I've started revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I've charted. Still, I can't get started with you. And it said so much about our relationship and his understanding of our wanting this relationship but not quite being able to get it, and he played this incredibly soulful solo, and we just locked eyes through the whole thing. And I would say that that was the best and most meaningful bridge for the two of us in finding a place for each other.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.